from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, for more than four decades, two American literary icons, author Wendell Berry and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder, corresponded with each other on topics ranging from art to the environment to their personal lives. Many of those letters have been collected in a new volume, Distant Neighbors, the selected letters of Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder, published by Berkeley's Counterpoint Press. And Snyder and Berry will join us to talk about their long-distance writerly relationship. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Two of the most important writers, public intellectuals, and ecology and nature advocates of our time, Gary Snyder and Wendell Berry, wrote 240 letters to each other in a correspondence that lasted 40 years. The letters, which are collected in a volume called Distant Neighbors and were edited by Chad Rigglesworth, are filled with their lives, their work, and their thinking, and they are a testament not only to the art of letter writing, still having life to it, but a vibrant and enduring friendship that included everything from reports on the weather and updates on family and relationships to intense and compelling discussions about poetry, the earth and its resources, animal life and religion. Gary Snyder won the Bullingen Prize in Poetry, the Kirsch Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Wallace Stevens Prize. In 1975, he won a Pulitzer Prize, and he presently lives in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Wendell Berry, who lives on a farm in Henry County, Kentucky, has been honored with the T.S. Eliot Award, the Aiken Taylor Award for Poetry, and the John Hay Award of the Orion Society, and both Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder join us for Forum Second Hour, and good to have you both back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here again.
Well, where do we begin? First of all, props to Chad Rigglesworth and to Jack Shoemaker, who I know has been kind of behind in all of this, Counterpoint Press. But let's talk about this. I use the word bromance, and neither of you are familiar with it. This is a jargon word for kind of fraternal feelings between men and a link between men. I found a link with you. I found a kind of fellowship with you in reading these letters. Not so surprising, many of these figures that appear out of the 70s, Sim Vanderen, Stuart Brand, people like Gregory Bateson, you know, I knew and interviewed back in that time. But what this really presented to me was an evolving friendship, and as I said, an enduring friendship, above all, almost.
Well, we had a lot to share to begin with, and so it was sharing a lot already. It was good to start arguing about some of it, too.
Well, there was arguing, but I think the arguing has been maybe a little bit overplayed because there's perhaps in fact, I found myself thinking this isn't so much maybe East as East and West as West. This is more kind of regional differences and upbringing differences and sensibility differences. You know?
Well, and also being interested in issues that are extremely large and difficult. And I don't think it's possible to carry on a conversation about those issues as if you had settled it and the other fellow hadn't. I think Gary and I both were conscious of being involved in an effort to make as much sense as we could of the predicament we felt we were in.
Let's talk about that predicament. I mean, we're talking about the planet, and we're talking about politics and all of that, but also Gary was a kind of Christian apostate, and you were, I think you call yourself a forest Christian or a renegade Christian, things along those lines, and there's one series of letters that goes back and forth about the Bible, Gary bringing up Job, you bringing up Genesis in terms of what how animals are to be treated and whether they should be looked at just as meat and so forth. And you really got in the weeds there, but it was fascinating stuff. It was a real colloquy.
Well, it's still a real question.
Yeah, and it's still a disagreement?
Oh, probably. Yeah, but that's not a huge thing. The intentions are good, but the way you work it out is a little different.
So where do you see the ongoing disagreement? Because you've been through many avatars in your own 40 years here.
Well, you're looking at me, so I'll answer. Yeah. The difference, one difference, which is a critical one, is between the Ten Commandments' first precept, thou shalt not kill, which means only human beings, and the East Asian and generally pre-modern so-called primitive religious outlook, which is that you should have some concern for all animals.
Still a disagreement, Wendell Berry?
Well, I would like to make a distinction between a difference and a disagreement. these differences originate from far back, before Gary and me. And the need that I had beginning in my thoughtful life was different from Gary's need. And I didn't need any help to become the first Buddhist in Port Royal, Kentucky. I felt a need to ransack the Western tradition and see if there was anything in there that could support me, including the Bible.
In fact, early on in your correspondence, you get into this difference about, I'll use the word difference as well, about occupation and what that word ought to mean.
Well, what what we had in common was an interest in work, an interest in the economies of places, the qualities of work, and so on, and how these could be supported and informed by the traditions that we had placed ourselves in. And so the difference to me means that we're always interested in what each other has each of us has been interested in what the other has had to say. So I don't greet Gary by wanting to know if he's come around on Christianity. He doesn't greet me by asking me if I've seen the greater truth of Buddhism. It hasn't happened.
That's not really what it's about.
That isn't what it's about.
Yeah.
It's about conversation. It's about mutual identification and just really exploration, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. The next good word is conversation.
Of how to deal with things. Yeah.
And I found a lot of this actually very moving. In fact, I wondered, when you were writing these letters, were you thinking about, I mean, because you're both writers, were you thinking, these are going to be read someday? These are going to have an audience other than each other?
Not me, no.
No, not at all. That didn't even enter your consciousness.
No.
I also found myself wondering just about the art of letter writing. I mean, you both do it very well, and yet in this digital world of ours seems to have become eclipsed.
We had no choice then, anyway.
No email.
No email.
No tweeting.
And, you know, I thought long-distance phone calls were too exorbitant. And in my family, we never had long-distance phones.
Yeah.
We never did it.
Plus, you were up there. You weren't getting great reception up there even today.
Never had a phone up there for the first 14 years. No, I'm talking about before I moved to the mountains, we had a phone once in a while. And in Japan, where I lived for 12 years, private people didn't have phones.
You didn't have them in the monastery either, I imagine.
Oh, no. Well, there was one phone in the monastery for the head monk who could call the teacher, the Roshi, over and let him talk to his friends.
So talk about, if you would, about how you each had influence over one another. I mean, there's a lot of editing of your work here. You're sending poems to each other and so on. Early on, you both wrote a poem about each other. Mm-hmm. We can explore that somewhat. But there's a kind of symbiotic relationship here, really, isn't there?
The word that you introduced into this conversation that was necessary was conversation. And when people undertake seriously to converse with each other, their task is to make as much sense as possible. And so when you have somebody who interests you talking to you, that person becomes a presence in your mind, and in that sense, an influence. And so you begin to have a double awareness. So I think, in one of my letters to Gary that my correspondence with him, my friendship with him, was analogous to binocular vision. I was seeing with another eye, which made mm-hmm. things more three-dimensional to me.
Early on, I mentioned that poem that Gary, there was a poem that you wrote. You were, I believe, with your son, and you were looking at some mallards, and that mm-hmm. prompted or inspired a poem about Gary because you were wishing that Gary was there with you, that his real physical
My son had wished it. Mr. Snyder, he said, I wish he'd been here.
Yeah. And so that sense of the importance of Gary, let's go back a little bit in time because I think your relationship, we trace it back. You were both kind of in Mill Valley in different times. You went and bought Rip Rap over at City Lights, I believe, before you even met Gary. Is that right?
Yes.
And Gary, you were in Mill
Quite
Valley.
Quite a while before.
And also wrote a poem about Wendell.
Well, I was in Japan for a long time. And when I came back to the States in 1958 or 59, one of the first things I ran across was some of the writings of Wendell. And he was already living in Kentucky by that time.
But didn't you have to go to Cincinnati at one point or then stop by to see him?
That gave me the opportunity to go see him, yeah. But we started talking to each other by letters even before that. And for me, it was recognizing in Wendell's writing a sympathetic mind, dealing with some of the same questions that I had. And there weren't very many others out there in 1958 that I felt that about.
Probably still aren't that many.
That is true.
Yeah.
Among the conservationists, the literary people, and so on, there are not that many people who are interested in the issues of settlement, how to live in a place, and the economic implications and cultural implications and artistic implications of that.
Also, how to live one's life. You know, I was reminded, Gary, in The Practice of the Wild, I'm going back a ways here, but you talk about not living meanly or stingily or thoughts of rudeness or thoughts of deed toward others or nature and conviviality, you talk about, interspecies community and communication. I mean, all of these kind of lofty things that normally aren't a part of discourse, but I talk about how we live a life.
But when I was saying those things and Wendell was saying those things, it wasn't like being lofty. It was like, what are we really doing?
It was like getting rooted to your existence,
yeah.
So this is a simpatico, regardless of all the differences or call them disagreements, whatever.
Well, in getting acquainted, getting at home, Gary's line, know the plants, learn the plants, is a real imperative for people who are trying to be settled in a place.
Yeah, place is so important in both of your work, and it comes across in the letters to each other, too. I mean, almost a sense of how sacred and how vital and necessary place is. But there's also this sense of living an ethical life that you both share and the importance of that, the vital nature of that.
And the question of what, you know, in some key parts, you know, what does constitute an ethical life?
Are we pretty much in agreement on that, you two?
I think we're pretty much in
agreement. Came across in the letters,
yeah. Oh, sure.
Gary would say, "Save all creatures." I would say,
"You know, but I have never said that exactly like that."
All right,
because I had to wrestle with the fact that
not an alligator, a crocodile. I mean, not all creatures. I had to wrestle with. I'm sorry. That was my quick response or association.
As a Buddhist, I'm not a strict vegetarian, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that means I've worked out a lot of moral questions in that regard over the years.
How are you on that, Wendell? You carnivore?
Yes.
Of course. So
of course. I come from grass country. I don't eat grass. I eat creatures who eat grass. I'm a vegetarian of the second level.
Well, how does that square, though, with this interspecies ethicality and the love of other species for both of you? How do you work that out?
Well, for me, part of it is learning to be really grateful. And as I said in Louisville, saying grace at meals. And that is the way our Upper Paleolithic ancestors dealt with it, too.
I found in reading the letters, you know, you kept coming back to myth and folklore in the earlier stages and to Asian culture and Native American culture, which you're so conversant with. And Wendell, back to his Christian roots, and yet again, this sense of place, of living the right kind of life, of living an ethical life, of pursuing knowledge and trying to answer questions that may be unanswerable, you seem to share in almost a communion-like way, if I can use that word.
Well, what is what is prior to all of modern civilization is small communities and villages of self-sustaining people.
And community has been very important in the work of both of you as well. Wendell, you're about to say.
Well, Gary, now you'll have to correct me again if I've got you wrong, but you wrote it in a wonderful little essay that your understanding of save all the creatures really meant allowing all the creatures to save you. Isn't that approximately it?
Oh, I did say that once, yes, but that's a secret.
But that was only once? Anyway.
Well, like the creatures that we live with, these ideas and themes have evolved, and they've gone in different directions through the years, as we could clearly map them out through your letters to each other.
Well, I think the great radical point of the Christian gospel is the importance of neighbors, of neighborliness. And to have neighbors for very long, and I have had neighbors for very long, is you realize that your kindness to them is in a way permitting them to be kind to you and to be saving you in a way. But the concept of neighborliness extends very readily to everybody else, the non-human members of the local community. And eating your neighbors requires a bit of an ethical leap, maybe, but you got to eat something. And vegetarianism isn't the answer to our need to live at the expense of other creatures. If I weren't living where I live and my family weren't living where I live, other creatures would be living where I live. And that they're not is just the same as if we had eaten them.
I remember thinking to myself, plants are other creatures too. Remember when they were saying plants can respond to human touch and they were trying to prove these hypotheses that were pretty far out there? And I thought, so you shouldn't eat plants because they're living. Maybe you shouldn't eat fruit because that's committing an abortion. I mean, there's no way to survive without eating something else that's part of nature.
Well, right? If you're going to live totally harmlessly,
yes,
there's no way out except the grave.
Or to be a breatharian. Don't they claim that they can?
Yeah, I've heard about breatharians.
I heard about that for a while, and then they all died.
They all expired. We're talking with Wendell Berry and Gary Steiner in their new book, Is Distant Neighbors, which collects the letters they wrote to each other over 40 years. And talking about neighborliness, Wendell, when I started reading this collection of letters, I thought, Amish social principles, we're getting a little esoteric here, but that's all about neighborliness in many ways, isn't it? I mean, you were writing about these to Gary, delineating what these Amish social principles are.
The principles, it seems to me, to be operative all the time. If you're treating somebody as if you're taking somebody seriously, if you're extending that courtesy, you're being a neighbor. And I have neighbors I agree with a lot less than I agree with Gary. And we get along pretty well. In fact, we love each other.
Did you hear the previous hour by any chance when we had Ted Olson and David Boies on? But these are two, I mean, they fought for marriage equality for gays and lesbians. And one was a hardcore conservative Republican. The other was a Democrat and liberal. And yet, a common cause. Common cause can be a big fact in terms of neighborliness and extending goodness to your...
This is an example to me of conversation. Any two people can sit down together and talk if they haven't already killed each other.
So you're both poets. Where does poetry come in terms of a different dimension of expression than, say, just conversation or the kind of connectedness through letter writing? Where does it have a dimension of its own, or does it?
Song, storytelling, neighborliness, sharing, deepening the possibilities of the language as you go, just like we might do a little bit in letters, but pushing it even harder.
Yes.
All of those things.
So there's more common ground here, and yet I was struck... let me open your book here. The case of one Patrick Murphy, who is mentioned in these letters to one another, who did a, I guess, did an essay when you were teaching at UC Davis, Gary, about your irreconcilable differences with Wendell Berry.
May I say something about Patrick Murphy? He comes from a very ideological, strict, black and white, dualistic background, and he changed from one variety of that background to another variety of that background, and then he became a professor in the English department, and he didn't change. He kept on thinking dualistically in black and white terms.
Well, let me also use that as a reference here early on in the letters to something, Wendell, that you write about students and not thinking. I don't know if you recall this, but you say in a letter to Gary that's actually written in February of 1980, you say, after Love to You All, signed Wendell, P.S., talking with some students the other night, I noticed that their thinking did not start with definition of a problem, but with vague personal concepts, their space, their thing, their life, etc. Have you experienced this? Never hit me so forcibly until then that starting where they start, they can't think. And the schools apparently aren't encouraging them to start anyplace else.
Well, to go back to this business of irreconcilable differences, we seem in our society to like those because it makes for a certain excitement. People with irreconcilable differences fight. But that's a tragedy. And if you live in this society and suffer it and worry about it, you begin to be unable to bear this idea of irreconcilable differences. And so what you want, I think, is a spirit of discourse, and that means going back to so simple things as terminology, getting the right words, which is very, very difficult. But people who are going to talk to each other can't talk as simply as individuals. They talk as sharers of a language and of a tradition of discourse. And so there's a difference between an exchange of gestures, verbal gestures or otherwise, and an exchange of speech.
Real conversation is an exchange. And irreconcilable differences don't necessarily mean intolerance, nor do they mean combative attitudes, right? I mean, that's what our media does all the time.
I want to say another word about neighborliness, too. There are short-term neighbors in your suburban neighborhood when you are going to move on in 2 or 3 years anyway. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the neighborliness that comes with people who are really intent on living in the place they're at for the better part of their life and who hope that their children will live there. In a neighborhood like that, there's going to be a lot of people you disagree with.
So do good fences make good neighbors?
Yeah,
like
it does. It makes good neighbors. Makes neighborliness.
We're talking about neighborliness. We're talking about vegetarianism, about conversation itself. We're having a wide-ranging conversation and a very fruitful one, I might say, with two extraordinary men. And talk about poetry. Talk about their work. We invite you into the conversation. You can join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with writer, critic, and farmer Wendell Berry and with Gary Snyder, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. They are co-authors of a volume of letters that cover 4 decades called Distant Neighbors, the selected letters of Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder. And they'll be in conversation at the Santa Rosa High School Auditorium, hosted by Copperfield's Books. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. And they're here with us in studio this hour, and we're talking about a number of subjects which you also are welcome to join us in conversation on. And, in fact, if you'd like to do that, you can do that by calling our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Two American literary icons corresponding on all kinds of topics, from art to the environment to their personal lives. But before we, and we're going to go to your calls in just a moment here, but before we went to the break, we were talking about neighborliness. So you've been fortunate enough to stay where you are and to pull down roots and to believe in place. What do you do about bad neighbors, though? I mean, there are a lot of people who are just, well, frankly, bad neighbors. Some wisdom to offer, Gary?
I've never had a really bad neighbor.
You've been fortunate. I can say the same. But Wendell?
I've had difficult neighbors. But the idea of neighbor and neighborliness got into this conversation appropriately. And another idea that belongs in it is courtesy. And I think that one of the things that neighborliness requires of you is courtesy. And if you have a difficult neighbor, and most people's neighbors aren't as good as they are, I think what neighborliness demands is that you don't say something to that neighbor that forbids that neighbor ever to say anything back to you. I think that governed my letters to Gary. If we have differences, but I didn't want to say anything to him that it would make it impossible or difficult for him to say something back to me. That seems to me to be courtesy.
Well, you're both high-minded, courteous men of generous spirits, but you can find a lot of uncivil people and a lot of people who are just belligerent, you know, who, even with courtesy and gentility, respond in ways that are frankly antipathetic.
It's partly a problem with North America. When I went to Japan, I really learned what good manners were, culturally speaking. Everybody was very careful with each other, small villages or big cities.
Our culture is lacking, is what you're saying, and that civility or that courtesy?
We're still learning how to get along with each other. We still move around all the time. We're still being transplanted or uprooted, and we still have a lot of different ideas that we think are important that aren't so important, maybe.
Maybe rules and rituals play a significant role in this as far as Japan versus North America?
Japan has a culture.
Well, as you've pointed out many times in your work, so do we when we go back to our indigenous roots. Let me go to our callers, and we'll begin with you. Tom, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. It's been a really fascinating conversation between you and two gentlemen guests. Yeah, I'm half Southern, and I have roots going back to Tennessee and Florida. And I just wanted to say back there, it's always been considered spiteful to build fences to shut out your neighbors. Goes back, I guess, to the hunting with the night hunts there for fox or raccoons or whatever. They would just roam back and forth, and they'd sit in somebody's backyard, listen to the hounds and or the horses and the trumpets, and then move on to the next piece of property without any regard to private property rights. They just, you know, wouldn't do any unnecessary damage, of course. So it's like a national park idea too, of everybody crowded into the park and camping in communal areas and kumbaya and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I think it's the Northerners, actually the Yankees, whatever, brought in the concept of fences. New Englanders, they just don't have the generosity of spirit that the Southerners have always had. And so that's something that the South can give to the whole nation, and maybe Northern Europe as well.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Tom, because, Kentucky is definitely the South, and those are Wendell's roots. There is in fact, I don't know if you know W.J. Cash's book. I'm sure you do, The Mind of the South, where he talks about Southern manner. You know, it's a sense of decorum and respect and everything. I mean, not always when it came to, let's say, slaves and all that sort of thing, but, you know, just in terms of the way you comport yourself. Wendell? It's different, isn't it?
I don't know whether I want to buy into these regional generalizations or not. General Sherman thought that bunch of well-brought-up young Southern men were the deadliest creatures ever on the planet. There wasn't anything to do but kill them. And he was right to a certain extent. They were bad eggs. I don't know how they hunt up north of the Ohio River. I have been up there a little bit. There are similarities. You know, and I never did actually know any hunters who wore red coats and rode to the hounds. But there is a different kind of respect of people's property in the daylight and in the dark. And I suppose that both is north and south of the Ohio River. There was a great deal, since we've gotten into this sectional business, I have to say that the Civil War in Kentucky was absolutely horrible. It was horrible for the whole nation. But the Civil War in Kentucky didn't end for about 40 years after after Appomattox. Mm. And it may be in some ways still going on, and it may be unfinished, in fact, in the whole country. That's one of the things wrong with wars.
Well, we were talking about Faulkner a little before we went on the air. Things stopped at Appomattox, you know, where Faulkner was concerned. Mm. I mean, you know, as far as being a Southerner was concerned, at least, or a Mississippian.
But people who've been terribly hurt by each other don't get over it just because a treaty's been signed. This is foolish. And this was the first industrial war. And in places like Kentucky, it really was a civil war. It wasn't a war between the states. And the leftovers went on and on and on, the retributions and vengeances and justices, the justices that were done by people riding at night. And
forgive me, it was also a major mistake, I've always felt, for the same thing happened with Germany, reparations to be imposed on the South by the North, just like they were imposed mm-hmm. on Germany. I mean,
after
all
World
that
War
enmity
I.
just continued so much as a result. Yeah.
Yes, people don't plead guilty and become nicer people because somebody has beaten the hell out of them.
Yeah. Could you talk? I want to go to more callers here, but could you talk, both of you, about, since you brought up hunting, I mean, is there an ethical way to hunt? Do you have to hunt with the idea that what you're going to shoot is going to be to eat and put on the table? Or what about the sport of hunting as opposed to that, hunting for just eating purposes?
People do hunt to eat still and need the food and are glad to have it. And there are ethical ways to do it and unethical ways, and those differences have to be observed. I don't hunt anymore. I used to when I was younger.
For sport?
For love. I like to be out in the woods early in the morning. I like to eat squirrels, but I have never guessed that you participated in hog killings and that sort of thing. And there's a right way and a wrong way. And the wrong way can make you feel terrible, and the right way can make you feel all right. Sometimes good.
We'll go to another call, and this is a Santa Rosa listener. Peter, you're on. Hi.
Oh, hi. Good morning. You're three gentlemen that I admire very much, and I was just telling my daughter, 15-year-old daughter, you've got to listen to these gentlemen. She's a vegan, so she's sitting in the car, and it tells to all of us that you're really making light of the suffering of your neighbors, of millions of creatures. They're slaughtered viciously. And there was laughter about truth being abortion. And I was really kind of offended. And she was shocked. I don't know if she would listen to the show again. Do you really take it that lightly, the millions of creatures that suffer so we can have food on our table?
Gary Snyder.
Have you ever thought about where your hamburger comes from or where your chicken comes from?
Yeah, that's why she's vegan and I'm vegetarian.
Well, so you've chosen that path, and that's good.
But he's saying that perhaps you don't take into account as profoundly as you should. If I'm interpreting you right here, Peter, the suffering that creatures go through to wind up on our table, whether it's a, you know, a fried chicken or a steak, a hamburger, whatever.
It is all, it all bears a lot of thought. And the least you can do is say thank you.
You talk about gratitude, though, but I mean, should you be grateful to these creatures? Should you express that gratitude? Because most of what you eat in the way of meat, you don't see, of course.
Well, I don't eat a lot of meat, but and hunting for me is subsistence hunting. And I don't even hunt anymore because I can pick up roadkill deer and deal with it. So that's where I get my venison.
Yeah. Wendell?
These days.
Wendell Berry?
Well, I've known very well a lot of creatures that I've eaten because I raised them and took care of them. I think that the vegetarians have every right to be vegetarians. When it becomes political, I began to be uneasy about it because I don't think they've come to terms with land use. It is a fact that when you take the animals out of agriculture, you depress the quality of the agriculture and you depress the quality of the minds involved. And I don't think we have time to go into that. But I live in a country that needs to be grassed, mostly grassed, because it's highly vulnerable to erosion. And to put that country into row crops in a massive way, as it is now being, that's now being done under the influence of high grain prices, is to desecrate and damage and destroy the country. It's to make it more toxic. It's to increase soil erosion. So if we want food from my country, we have to take it from grazing animals predominantly. And that is a complicated argument. I've started to make it, but it's an argument that has to be made.
Let me bring up another complicated argument. There are those who point their fingers at tobacco farmers, and you were a tobacco farmer. I mean, those.
No,
are your,
I wasn't.
Weren't you? Were those your roots?
I never raised a crop of tobacco for myself in my life. I've worked with my neighbors who were tobacco farmers and helped them in their crops. From a very young age to a pretty old age.
What about that argument, though, that, you know, tobacco is so toxic and it causes cancer and therefore tobacco farmers need to...
You can't argue in favor of tobacco, and I've never attempted to. I have argued in favor of the tobacco program, which was a model program, quite apart from the stigma of tobacco. And, in fact, the Organic Valley Dairy Program is modeled on the tobacco program.
Let me read some listener comments. Here's a listener says, thank you for this show. I'm a poet, and I have had a long-time pen pal relationship with another friend and poet who lives across the country. We share much fellowship and conversation through our letters, particularly the opportunity to bring difficult topics out of the silence. I want to affirm the power of letter writing in our lives during times that do not readily support such slowness and commitment in comparison to, say, a Twitter-type conversation. Blessings to Gary and Wendell. Another listener writes,
thank you.
I remember attending a poetry reading by Gary Snyder at the Living Batch Bookstore in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the early 1990s. His poem Oil still stands out in my mind as a trenchant observation that capitalism and industrialism are ideologies with religious-like aspects. I find the poem's images of steel plates and long injections of pure oil returning to mind again and again as I've watched the slow encroachment of development throughout Northern California. I have to admit, when I started reading your letters, it was coming to haunt me. You were writing about the drought in California back in 1977.
We had a three-year drought then that people don't remember right now.
Here's Lynn who writes, I'm so thrilled to hear Wendell Berry on the air. My group, the Pacific Mozart Ensemble, recorded a CD of Dave Brubeck's choral music called Brubeck and American Poets. It includes two settings of Wendell Berry poems, The Wheel and the Elegiac, The Peace of Wild Things. And Anthony from North Columbia writes, just out of curiosity, do either Wendell or Gary have anything to say about William Everson?
William Everson, the poet.
William Everson, the poet, I'm sure, yeah.
Well, I've read him, and with appreciation, yes. I didn't know him.
question about Everson reminds me about Emerson. I was going to ask you to, because as you go through 40 years, as I said, there's a lot of changes in views and a lot of adding and subtracting. And as I said, your whole relationship and your conversation together has enhanced you both in so many ways. What about consistency?
The hobgoblin
of low minds. Yeah. That's what Emerson said. You know, it's always stayed with me about, you know, consistency, I think, is a good thing, isn't it?
You know, the thing that Emerson said that stays with me is in his talk after Thoreau's death, he said, Henry David Thoreau was a captain of huckleberry picking parties. A criticism.
Yes. Well,
and beautiful sentences in that essay in honor of Thoreau. Emerson could write beautiful sentences.
But Thoreau came up with I don't know, maybe this is apocryphal. You two can.
So I think being a captain of a huckleberry picking party is a great thing.
Well, I also think it was a great thing allegedly attributed to Thoreau when Emerson came to see him when he was in prison for not paying the poll tax that supported the Spanish-American War. And he said, what are you doing in there, Ralph? And supposedly Emerson said, what are you doing out there?
Right.
Yeah. Charles writes, please share a memory of the summer that Ginsberg helped with the building of your cabin. This is to you, Gary, obviously, in the Sierras. Also, your connection via Buddhism and the poetics program at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, Alan never helped me on my house. I helped him on his house, though, which was built down at the lower end of our meadow. And later he and I worked it out for him to return it to me because he became involved with Naropa and no longer wanted to come out to the West Coast. It's the difference between Vajrayana and, I guess, Rinzai Zen.
Well, and so many people, of course, remember, especially in the San Francisco area, who have their memories long enough, that famous reading of Ginsberg's of Hal. But you were there too, Gary, reading at that momentous reading.
Oh, that was a great evening, yeah.
Yeah. Let me bring another caller on here. And by the way, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join the program, or you can email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Miles. Good morning, Miles.
Hi, my name's Miles. I'm calling from Menlo Park. And I'm actually just responding to a small point that was brought up in the postscript of one of the letters mentioned. And I didn't really understand the point. It was that students these days think or talk from personal experience or from personal bias. And it seemed like you were making a difference or a contrast between students and the rest of the population. And as a student, I didn't quite get how we really are any different than anybody else in that sense.
Wendell, that was your comment that I read from 1980 letter. I don't know if you want to hold to it, but you're both educators. Do students think differently or not think at all, like you were kind of implying in that postscript?
I don't know whether I ought to be held responsible for something I said in 1980 or not.
Well, you can always say some students don't think, right?
Yeah, some students. I'll amend that if I didn't say it in the letter, some students.
Let me thank the caller. Here's Maria who writes, how about bringing up feedlots? Factory farming is the crime. It's very different from raising an animal with care.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And Doug Tompkins' big book on the tragedy of industrial meat raising is really to the point.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a fundamental contradiction between industry and agriculture. It's going to continue for a while, but industrial agriculture has failed.
It's also had an extraordinarily toxic effect on the environment. I mean, when a lot of people say don't eat meat, they're talking about because of the effect of industrial produced food.
Well, when they talk about not eating meat, most people don't distinguish between grain-fed meat and grass-fed meat, and that is a vital distinction. The grass-fed meat are truly agricultural animals. Grain-fed meat is industrial meat and shouldn't be eaten if you know it ahead of time.
Well, we're ahead of the learning curve in California because on many restaurants you'll see grass-fed beef.
That's true.
Yeah.
Just in the last 10 years.
It is really just in the last decade, Gary. You're right. Yeah.
True, but the acreage under that influence is still pitifully small, and there is a lot a lot of the vast amount of agricultural land in this country is now being abused.
So what can be done about that?
It's toxic.
I mean, you know, you're always thinking of policy. What about all that abuse of land?
Well, this is the kind of question that has no easy answer. If we wanted to farm better, even if we decided to and made a policy of farming better, we don't have the people who know how to farm better. We have effectively killed off the farm population. And how to get it back is not an easy problem.
I'm going to bring another caller in here. But, Gary, just like I asked Wendell about what we can do about factory farming, I ask you kind of an offbeat question that's always been in my mind where you're concerned. You've spent so much time immersed in Eastern philosophy and Eastern religions, and what I'm wondering is there are some people who think they can actually think, and we're talking about thinking again, in an Eastern way. But if you're nurtured and trained on Western culture, you're literally fed on Western culture, can you really kind of transmogrify your mind into Eastern thinking?
I've never tried to do that. I just have tried to learn to think. I don't think that there is a gap between Eastern and Western thinking that is so great. If you just go back 7,000 or 8,000 years, we're all in the same mind, basically. And there are little offshoots here and there of unique nationalism and unique economies, but we can overcome that.
I'm thinking, though, of, I'm going to get too deep in it. You write a lot about theology, but I'm thinking about eschatology, because the Western notion is you live, you die, and maybe you're resurrected or reborn in heaven or hell or whatever. But that's not Eastern thinking. Not a lot of Eastern thinking is reincarnation. It's not linear thinking as much. It's
This is too educated in our discussion. Most people think the same out there, not having read a lot of books.
Agree, Wendell?
All you need to think is two things, and then you can compare them. That, to me, is thinking.
Two ideas at the same time.
Yeah, you can't think about one thing. You're not allowed to. Well, I think that was what I was complaining
impermissible.
About some students. They were assuming you could think about one thing. If you want to think, you can think about the difference between vegetarianism and agriculture that uses animals.
Here's another easy question from a listener named James. You know, we're grappling with some pretty heavy-duty questions here. But here's James, who writes, what do our two philosopher poets think about climate chaos in each person's part or societies in dealing with it if they believe it's occurring and man-made?
Gary, you're passing it off on me.
Oh, he's being polite. After you, Gaspard.
Well, the peculiar thing to me about climate change is that if I believe in it, I have to believe in it on faith, which I do. I think the scientists must be competent and that they deserve to be paid attention to. But this is not something that I can know for myself. Now, I've known about climate change ever since I was a little boy, because the generation of our grandparents were always talking to us about the winters of their childhood that were more severe than the winters of mine. And that is a fact. My country's full of ice houses. That is, places where they stored ice from the river through the summer. My wife and I have lived on the Kentucky River right on the banks for the last 50 years, and it's frozen once in that time. So there is a change. But what the scientists are saying, they understand. I don't understand. But climate change is based on waste and pollution. Those are wrong. And I think that those things ought to be addressed, because when people run to climate change, it seems that they're asking for some kind of a global change of policy. People need to take charge of these matters of pollution and waste on their own.
Something to add here, Gary Snyder?
Well, climate change has been going on for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. At one time, there were palm trees growing in Greenland, in what is now Greenland. At the moment, we are still in an ice age. If you take the technical definition of ice age as whenever it is that in the Arctic or Antarctic summer, the ice doesn't entirely freeze. So we are moving possibly toward a more normal planet. But I do believe that this is not really quite right, and that it is probably caused by industrial activity added on to extraordinary population growth and the fact that we're running out of those high-quality energy sources, and we've got a lot of problems.
Well, we'll leave it there with the problems, but it's so good to have you both here and to read the engagement you have with ideas here on the air and to read about them, and you can read about them over the course of 40 years in Distant Neighbors, Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder's correspondence with each other. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion. In fact, welcome continuing this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And we remind you that we always welcome your thoughts about what you hear on forum or would like to hear. And you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. But today it's John, excuse me, it's... Give me your name.
Wendell Berry.
It's Jim Bennett. I'm sorry, Jim. Senior editors Dan Zoll, interns Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Charlie Zaharoff, Eric Nygaard, and Kay Lynn Dakin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.